This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The television version of the show airs on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. Remember the Bundy brothers-led takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon earlier this year? Well, the armed right-wing group laid siege to federal lands for months before they were finally arrested. On Thursday, all seven people arrested, including Ammon and Ryan Bundy, were surprisingly acquitted of all federal conspiracy and weapons charges. The timing of the acquittals couldn't have been better. It offered a sharp contrast to the ongoing presence of indigenous and environmental activists in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline. That much larger and more popular mobilization has faced massive police opposition, arrests, and violence. My guest Arun Gupta, who had covered the Bundy brothers' occupation in Oregon, recently wrote in Raw Story that, quote, the acquittal of Bundy's is proof of racial double standards and a green light for right-wing terrorism. Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He writes regularly at Telesur English and was a founding editor of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He's also a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali, and he's in town in Southern California, now joins me in studio. Welcome to the program, Arun Gupta, this time in person.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Sonali.
Last time I had you in person was on the floor of the, or next to the floor of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, where this major battle was playing out between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. We're just about a week away from the election. A lot of things in the news. One of the things that has been occupying the minds of a lot of progressive activists is an action happening in North Dakota that on this program we've been covering extensively. And a sort of perfect timing to illustrate double standards was the acquittal of the Bundy brothers and their cohort, seven people arrested who had been occupying the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon earlier this year. You had reported on that occupation, that right-wing occupation, and even talked about it on our program. Now these folks have been completely acquitted, and you see that as a double standard?
Yeah, I mean, for one, it's a complete farce. The government must have epically botched the case. What it turned on was whether there's a conspiracy and intent to prevent the Fish and Wildlife employees from working at the refuge, the Malheur National Refuge, where I spent a week. And that was clearly the intent of the Bundy brothers. They, you know, came with guns. They blockaded it. They said they were going to turn it into a local county resource center. So on the one hand, this is just a case of, I think, prosecutorial, malpractice, but it does also, I think, highlight a double standard in terms of how the government took a very hands-off approach to them for well over a month, and yet in Dakota, you know, we've seen just this massive amount of force unleashed against Native American protesters and supporters trying to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Now, the folks that were occupying the wildlife refuge in Oregon were notably, were different in two very notable ways, primarily one, white and right-wing, but I think even more important way, they were armed. And the folks in North Dakota have made it a very strong point to say that they are unarmed. So you say in the piece that you wrote for Raw Story that this essentially opens the door to right-wing terrorism. That's strong language.
Well, you know, that is even by the FBI's own statistics, most of the violent terrorism in terms of people who've been killed since 9/11, it's been a result of right-wing terrorism, not, so-called like the radical jihadi terrorism that we've seen. And that is a phenomena. You know, right after Obama came into office, there was that Homeland Security report talking about that the biggest threat is right-wing terrorism, and that, you know, the right went crazy, they went nuts, and the Obama administration essentially, not only did they disown the report, they dismantled the monitoring desk in terms of like collecting information. And so, you know, when it comes to the Bundy brothers, they first came to prominence with with the standoff in 2014 at their father's ranch, Clive and Bundy, in Nevada, where they surrounded government agents and had guns trained on them. You know, that right there involves all sorts of federal crimes. And if the silver lining, if there is any, they're now going to go to trial for that case. But the Malheur occupation was actually the fourth attempted takeover of federal lands, either by the Bundys or their supporters, following that standoff in Nevada. So I think, you know, this basically opens the door, an invitation. You know, you can just come in with all sorts of guns and militias and say, hey, we're not trying to prevent, you know, the Bureau of Land Management or the National Forest Service from doing their job. You know, we're just here with our guns. Of course, the thing is, it's illegal to have guns on federal land, on or a lot of types of federal land. So I'm not sure what's going on with that, whether they're going to bring another case to that, because they were basically acquitted on all charges, except one. I believe there was a hung jury. So this was just the government completely botched this case.
Meanwhile, in terms of what's happening in North Dakota, a lot of people see that as a really important turning point, and also a movement that's symbolic of so many important issues: native rights, treaty rights, fossil fuel use, the protection of resources, environmental racism, climate change, and on and on. So a lot of people are seeing this as a very important sort of symbolic movement led in particular by Native Americans to pay attention to. Both the presidential candidates have been resoundingly silent on this issue. Trump, for obvious reasons, he actually has interest in fossil fuel companies. And then young Native activists recently went and occupied the Brooklyn office of Hillary Clinton, demanding that she say something about this. How important is it for us to hold Clinton accountable? How in favor of these sorts of pipeline interests is the Democrat?
Oh, absolutely. One should never mute any sort of criticism of the powerful, especially of people like the Clintons. They're thoroughly corrupt. You know, they're completely tied in to the energy and industry. It's you know, there are plenty of Democrats who are saying, like, oh, and even progressives, you know, we need to mute criticism. It's like, no, you criticize them, even if you believe that Trump should be defeated, which I do, which means, you know, that Clinton is preferable. You know, it's basically the neoliberal warmongers preferable to the proto-fascist. They have to be held accountable. You know, and a couple of things I do want to mention about the whole occupation in Oregon that I think are pretty interesting is, one, this was a Burns Paiute land, right? You know, that this is also native land, and they were running this heavy equipment across. They were engaged in theft of government equipment, destroying these sensitive archaeological sites, digging through a lot of the material that had been stored. And secondly, this whole type of land takeover movement, which is rampant west of the Rockies, because the federal government in a number of states actually controls the majority of the land, a lot of it is being funded by the Koch brothers, who are energy interests. And the idea is that they're trying to demand, like, oh, all this land should be turned over to the states and local governments. And that's exactly what the Bundys were talking about. You know, and I spent 2 hours in Ryan Bundy's pickup truck talking with him. And, you know, he's just like, this needs to be turned over to the people, you know, to the people who are going to work the land. And what do they mean? They're talking about logging, grazing, mining, drilling interests. But the states and counties don't have the resources to manage the land, so they would sell it off to all these big energy interests, to all these big timber companies, to the huge, like, cattle companies. So this, I think, is just, it shows you such the incredible contrast with what's going on in North Dakota, you know, that it's people who are trying to defend the integrity of their land, right? You know, there's a, obviously difference. It may not be going directly across reservation land, but it will severely damage and destroy it if there's any sort of spill. And we know that spills always do happen.
Right. That pipeline would go under the Missouri River. And back to the Bundy issue, they're not necessarily directly saying, we want this land to be turned over for corporate pillaging. So states' rights is often a cover for this sort of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, they talk about, you know, we need to bring jobs, we need to create jobs. And again, this is, you know, it's a red herring, because you're not going to go back to the 1950s, where you have, like, Harney County is this, it's bigger than the state of Connecticut. That's where the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge is located, but there's only 7,000 people who live there. In the 1950s, there were hundreds of timber jobs. The thing is, mechanization alone has basically destroyed, like, a huge amount of these jobs. So even if you bought back, like, a rampant timber industry, you'll probably only find like a few score of jobs. But it also ignores the fact that actually the wildlife refuge is a major employer out there. You know, that it, and it does bring in a huge amount of tourism. You know, if there is any sort of, like, hopefully silver lining, it's that people have learned this is one of the most important flyways. You know, it's something like over 200 species of migratory birds pass through and often, like, you know, raise chicks, fledglings in nest and raised there. So it's really an incredibly important and beautiful place in terms of wildlife. But they basically, you know, it's this ideology that's completely all backwards that they're trying to promote, that their future doesn't lie with timber.
So back to North Dakota and the attempt by Native activists to hold the Clinton campaign accountable after young activists occupied her Brooklyn office. Her campaign finally did release a statement, and all the statement essentially said was everyone's voices need to be heard, and it's important for us to preserve the rights of people to protest and the rights of workers to have a safe working environment. And I'm wondering if that is a hint toward the AFL-CIO's recent statement in support of the Dakota Access Pipeline, much to the shock of a lot of progressive activists. The AFL-CIO, of course, like many big labor unions, having unquestionably backed the Clinton campaign.
Well, you know, this is coming from the trades union, LIUNA, the Labor's, I forget exactly what it stands for, it's this Labor something of North America. But the trade unions are gung-ho. I mean, you know, if basically their jobs in planetary ecocide, the trade unions would be in favor of it. That's their stance. And, you know, this absurdity about safety, it's just like, who is actually the ones threatening the safety? You have these heavily militarized police, like these pictures of these armored personnel carriers, you know, these police in full body gear, using chemical weapons, using violence against peaceful protesters. They're the ones who are actually creating the unsafe conditions. And then when it comes to the pipelines themselves, right, you know, you often hear about, oh, how dangerous it is to be a cop. It's actually far more dangerous to work in extractive industries, logging, fishing, mining, and so on. And this is the corporations. And we see time and time again, you know, with these oil bomb trains, with Massey and the coal industry, that they will basically completely undermine occupational safety for their workers. These corporations have spent decades attacking OSHA and destroying its ability to enforce and oversee workplace safety. They're the ones who are killing off their workers. They're the ones who are putting them at these grave and mortal risks just for profit. So again, it's just like, this is just kind of the worst sort of Stockholm syndrome, and AFL-CIO and LIUNA are on the wrong side of history. And, you know, and the more important point is, we have to stop this, because obviously it's destroying the planet. Why are we continuing with this? And the Clinton administration's approaches, as we've seen from the WikiLeaks email, they don't want to take a stand on anything. But I think one of the real nuggets in there is that they actually talk about, you know, if we're pushed, we may have to take a stand. And I'm not talking about an inside strategy. You know, it's just like, the more disruption, the more protests, the bigger movements of resistance, not polite protests, but actually disrupting through strikes, boycotts, sit-ins, direct action that progressive and forces and the left can raise, that will have a greater impact. So this should be a call for people to protest more and create more disruptions.
So, Arun, you've often been a strong critic of labor, organized labor's cozy relationship with the Democrats, but also one of the most important things that the big labor unions, SEIU in particular, has managed to do over the last few years is bring to prominence the Fight for 15 movement around the country, fast food workers, but then there's also our Walmart and Walmart workers, many different workers groups asking for $15 an hour. You've critiqued some of those movements for not being worker-led enough, for not allowing the workers in whose names those campaigns are run to have enough of a say. But recently you wrote about another union that actually did point, in your view, to the best way for workers to organize, and this is a Burgerville workers union. Burgerville, for those people who aren't familiar, is a chain of fast food places around the Pacific Northwest. Tell us about this particular struggle.
Yeah, this is a Wobbly-led industrial workers of the world, which has its roots in the Pacific Northwest. Burgerville is about a 42 outlet chain. Their whole cachet is its local, kind of gourmet food, but fast food. And so, but as with any fast food job, it's high paced, almost no benefits, no security, and minimum wage or barely above it. So workers there decided, since the Wobblies have real roots in the Pacific Northwest, there are a number of people who are working at Burgerville who are members of the IWW, and they're like, hey, let's try to organize this. And the IWW's model is it's worker-led, it's worker-centric. The workers themselves are the organizers. And so, I would recommend people check out the story on In These Times, the website, because it's a great look at how actually you build a shop-by-shop movement, a rank-and-file movement. The thing about the Fight for 15, this is very much a top-down movement. It's not that the workers are saying, oh, we'd like more of a voice. They have zero voice, right? I was at the Fight for 15 convention in Richmond, and they have no input whatsoever. They are just completely passive. They have no input on strategy, not even on slogans. Everything is completely stage managed. SEIU spends a huge amount of money on lawyers and PR firms. And then they're completely in bed with the Democratic Party. And we just saw this, there's been a lot of exposés, the labor press is talking about it extensively, how these different union leaders like Mary Kay Henry of SEIU, Randy Weingarten of the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, how they're actually working with the Clinton camp to suppress other unions who are more critical of her, Randy Weingarten multiple times says she'll attack National Nurses United because they supported Bernie Sanders.
This is as revealed in the WikiLeaks emails.
Revealed. And it's really, and I think there's the left ends up focusing too much on Hillary Clinton. I call it the Hillary games, right? Like the Hunger Games. The idea that you can just take out the one bad person and everything is okay. This is a complete misunderstanding of what's going on. There's a huge power apparatus where everyone is complicit. And the fact is, I've only been doing labor reporting for a few years now, but I came to a conclusion quite a while ago that essentially most of the leaders of the big labor unions are enemies of the working class. That is the reality, and the left needs to understand that.
Yeah, and so one would have imagined, given that many of these big unions threw their weight behind Hillary Clinton, some very early in the game, that she would have made as a central plank of her campaign a $15 an hour federal minimum wage, which he hadn't done and has only given sort of nominal support, probably because Bernie Sanders had so much traction. They couldn't even take for granted this very simple demand for her to adopt. So, what sort of political price do they extract from Clinton by supporting her?
They just want to have a seat at the table. You know, Francis Fox Piven, the great sociologist, has talked about this going back to the 1930s, that the labor leaders were in awe in being of the halls of power. You know, I think some of it is cultural, but also, you know, they think that this is where power really derives from. And once, you know, you have the period of McCarthyism where, like, the left is really destroyed as a critical mass within organized labor, the union leaders really have no interest whatsoever in worker power, in rank and file democracy. They don't do worker education of any sort anymore. They don't like do any sort of like class consciousness. You know, they don't even talk about working class. They always say middle class, right? So, you know, with the Clinton camp, so we hear from these WikiLeaks emails, Mary Kay Henry, where the Clinton camp is talking about they're worried about how she's going to like have a big ask because they supported, you know, they were pushing SEIU to support Clinton, even though she was opposed to 15 an hour, and they were, and there was a candidate, Bernie Sanders, who supported their primary demand. And then at one point, the Clinton camp is breathing a sigh of relief because it's just like, oh, Mary Kay Henry's not going to ask that much from us. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, what type of leader is this that you're completely in bed with the pro-war, pro-Wall Street party? And the fact of the matter is, most unions see their reproduction through the corporations themselves. So they actually ally themselves with the corporations. They are more in bed with the corporations and more favorable than they are to their own rank and file workers.
So, Arun, for all of these criticisms of Hillary Clinton, all of which are valid, you have also made it a point this election season that progressives and the broad liberal left needs to hold their nose and vote for the Wall Street, pro-Wall Street neoliberal war hawk, because many on the left seem to or may be underestimating the what Donald Trump really represents. Let's talk about what Trump really represents. It's very easy to watch him in the debate and dismiss him as a bumbling fool who, you know, has sort of made it, has lowered the quality of any kind of political discourse, which wasn't high to begin with. But what is the true thing we have to really worry about?
Yeah, Trump, his candidacy comes down to one issue, and I think no one's really hit the nail on the head in this regard. It's ethnic cleansing, right? That is what really brings all his policies together. We're going to get rid of all these illegals. And when you I've interviewed more than 100 of supporters around the country, and what they talk about Mexicans, it's just like, you know, don't go making my neighborhood look like Mexico. You know, we don't want to see your quinceañera or a Cinco de Mayo. You know, it's about removing them from the public sphere. So they want to deport, you know, these huge amount of people. And, you know, it's just like, yes, of course, Obama is the deporter in chief, but this is a completely different scale. On Donald Trump's website, they actually call for like reducing immigration to historic low levels, right? So that, and no one's picked up on this either. You know, go to his website on the immigration. They link to an article. This would mean cutting the number of immigrants in this country actually by 2/3, or getting rid of 27 million immigrants. Yeah, he calls for like eliminating categories of legal immigration. They want to, you know, strip birth. They want to overturn the 13th Amendment, I guess, right? Birthright citizenship, right? So this is really radical. And then when you look at, you know, the banning of Muslim immigration, the registering of Muslims over here, he's talked about closing down mosques, right? These are really radical proposals. Then when you look in regards to African Americans, national stop and frisk, voter suppression that they're now engaging in, you know, it's the law and order stuff. You know, they talk about like making saying Black Lives Matter is a terrorist outfit. There's no legal distinction, but if the FBI did that, like it did to the animal rights, environmental right movement, under Bush, right? In 2005, they said the number one domestic threat is the animal rights movement and the ELF, the Earth Liberation, ELF and ELF. Yeah. And that had a devastating effect on the radical environmentalism movement. And so, you know, this, again, you know, you can start to see how this all ties together, right? So when they say make America great, like I've talked, I always ask the supporters, so when was America last great? And for them, it's like, what was surprising? I thought they'd say like 50s, maybe 60s. 60s. You know, and some of them do, but a lot of them will say like before FDR, you know, 1920s, early 1900s, a few like late 19th century. And the thing we have to, this is when Jim Crow was law of the land, that African Americans, Chicanos, Native Americans live under this apartheid state, this regime of racial terror. This is what they are nostalgic for. And this is what Trumpism represents. And of course, it's not going to end with him, but do you want to see these type of people have state power? You know, people like the Bundys.
Well, Arun, he has said that Indians and Hindu Americans will have a friend in Trump, so I suppose you and I will be okay.
As long as we're Islamofascists, or I mean Islamophobes, you know,
Right. Yeah, and this is really bizarre. He has allied himself not just with Vladimir Putin, although he claims he's not, but with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Recently, recorded a very hard to watch ad of him speaking in Hindi. That I oh, it was very just yeah I don't know if you've seen that, but it's pretty bizarre. And so right, so what unites him with other brown people is a distaste for a third group of brown people or a second group of brown
Right.
people.
Yeah, I meant Hindu fascism, right? You know, that's who the BJP really represents, and that's why they love Trump. I mean, it's really vile. Like, you know, I've seen this on social media, getting attacked by like Hindu fascists or even some Sikhs who are like just virulently Islamophobic and pro-Trump.
So we just have a few days before the election, and of course, what's much more important than the election, if the polls are right and Hillary Clinton wins, what's much more important is what comes after the election. And despite whatever criticism one might have of Julian Assange, the revelations in WikiLeaks to me offer a really great starting point for progressives to agitate from the left and push Clinton right from day one on the left to make it very clear she doesn't have a mandate from the liberal voters that might have voted for her. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, you know, from the beginning, and the criticism I've gotten, a lot of people don't realize the very first article I wrote, which is called The Only Article You Need to Read About the 2016 Election. I wrote that 18 months ago. The whole point of it is just like the left obsesses over voting. It actually makes it out to be much more important than it is. It has a neoliberal approach, right? Lesser evilism is neoliberal because this is not about evil. That's morality. It's an individualistic response. This is about a system. And unfortunately, the reality is there are only two choices. But voting is a one-second act, right? And it only has an effect as an aggregated mass act. Your individual voting, your conscience is irrelevant. That's neoliberal. That's in an individual choice. What matters is what you do politically. And so what I said from the beginning, like, sure, you know, it would be better if the right-wing crazy is defeated. We didn't know who was going to be in the spring of 2015. Now it's clear. But pour all your energy into independent organizing. Don't go do any work for the Democratic Party. Don't give them any money. Don't do get out the vote. That's what I argued all along, and I still argue. Criticize Clinton constantly, right? You know, hold her feet to the fire now and after. But stop obsessing over how terrible she is. We know that. The point is, what are you going to do about it?
Arun, thank you so much for joining us in person. We'll have you back on in the future again. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you as always.
My guest is Arun Gupta, an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He writes regularly at Telesur English. He's also a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUwithSonali.